The newspapers made much of the fact that Manson had once been a familiar figure in Haight-Ashbury, and that he and his family used acid and chattered about revolution. The lawyers for the defense tried to blame the slayings on the deleterious effects of hallucinogenic drugs, an argument that had about as much credence as the notion that LSD was responsible for generating the good vibes at Woodstock. If the Tate killing showed anything, it was that acid has no implicit moral direction. The Manson affair was a vivid refutation of the 60s myth that anyone who took LSD would automatically become holy or reverential or politically conscious or anything else except stoned. The canonization of Manson by certain segments of the counterculture was a measure of how desperate and bitter people had become in the final days of the 1960s. Jerry Rubin confessed that he fell in love with Manson's, quote, cherub face and sparkling eyes when the accused murder appeared on television. Tuesday's Child, an underground paper in Los Angeles, named him Man of the Year and ran his picture with the word hippie as the caption. The Weathermen went a step further by lauding Manson as a heroic, acid-ripped street fighter who offed some, quote, rich honky pigs, unquote. Dig it, exclaimed Bernadine Dorn. First they killed those pigs, then they ate dinner in the same room with them, then they even shoved a fork into a victim's stomach. Wild. The Weather People proclaimed 1970, quote, the year of the fork, in Manson's honor.
This, again, is worth reflecting on against the background of the Reagan Revolution. I think one of the aspects of the 60s that has been largely overlooked, in particular by more progressive or liberal reflections on that particular period, is the bitterness that this type of thing, and we're not saying that everybody or even most people necessarily involved with anti-war or, quote, counterculture, unquote, activities were of this frame of mind. Rather, we're suggesting that perhaps this frame of mind had a lot to do with the subsequent change in political directions that this country underwent. A lot of the neoconservatism one sees, in particular among people who did at one point throw their lot in with the anti-war movement or went to rock concerts or things of that kind, were part of the youth movement, quote-unquote, which I have a tough time saying without laughing to myself. But there was, in fact, very much that kind of an awareness at the time. One wonders how much of the neoconservatism was a direct result of this, not only the kinds of activities of agent provocateur groups like the Manson family, but their canonization by people like the Weatherman. I mean, this kind of stuff, repeating the quote here from Bernadine Dorn, dig it, exclaimed Bernadine Dorn. First they killed those pigs, then they ate dinner in the same room with them, then they even shoved a fork into a victim's stomach. Wild. And then to proclaim 1970, the year of the fork. Can you imagine how this kind of thing, first of all, would have been received by the kinds of average citizens that Ed Butler is talking about? Bearing in mind Ed Butler's quote, what, how are they to feel when they see, first of all, the killings themselves, and then see this kind of thing hailed as a progressive type of activity?
And of course, the victim who had the fork stuck into her stomach was, in fact, the pregnant Sharon Tate, if I remember correctly.
Eight months pregnant, and she sat on her knees begging for the life of her child, at which point they continued to cut her to gristle, and when it, as I said, shoved a carving fork into her stomach.
Now, you juxtapose this with the fact that the Weather Underground, or the Weathermen, as they were then called before they decided that the name was sexist, that the Weathermen at this time were talking about, you know, a world of justice, and that the only way to bring justice is to, you know, overthrow these vicious, you know, racist, sexist institutions. Again, the average person on the street hears these people saying we have to overthrow the institutions to bring on something better, and then hears the fork stabbing of a pregnant woman being cited as a wild revolutionary gesture. It's very surprising that, and of course it's quite obvious the kind of effect that would have, and it's certainly the obviousness of that kind of effect certainly would not have been missed by those in positions of power trying to protect those positions of power.
The ways in which these kinds of actions and statements were received, say, by a guy whose son is over in Vietnam fighting with the 1st Cavalry Division, say, or say the son when he comes back from Vietnam, you know, and he's just been through that whole situation. Now, you're talking about a kid anywhere from maybe 19 to 23 years old, not terribly sophisticated politically, not even terribly old, let's face it. At that point, not even able to vote, because 18-year-olds couldn't vote in those days. And he comes back, and here are people's, you know, here's the year of the fork. If you can imagine anything more disgusting. And this type of thing, I think, has to be considered. When you consider Ed Butler, the disinformation specialist from the John Kennedy assassination, well-placed for the Robert Kennedy assassination, in and of itself inextricably linked with the Manson case. And then you see the Weather Underground, you know, and their Year of the Fork, the political reaction of the 80s, and you bear in mind that Patrick Frawley was one of Reagan's major political backers, that Reagan was the governor of California at this time, and as we looked at in RFA 23, and as we've touched back on in a number of other programs, the types of terrorist activities that were so characteristic of California under Ronald Reagan have then been expanded like droplet throwing a rock into a pond. The ripples have spread outward in a national setting.
And we should just mention, since it's about that time.
Okay. And again, we're going to read you a little more about the Weather Underground. They're one group that bears a lot of investigation. There are some interesting connections between members of that family and elements of the national security establishment, or elements of some of the families of people involved. One in particular, not Bernadine Dorn, but one of the other people who was involved with the Weather Underground is a daughter of a long-standing CIA family, many, many CIA agents in the family. We'll perhaps touch on that at a future time. But the Weather Underground, in addition to coming up with such delightful concepts as the Year of the Fork, and again, if you can imagine anything more Fritz Harman-like than plunging a carving fork into the stomach of a woman who's 8 months pregnant and begging on her knees for her baby's life, if you can think of anything more disgusting than that, but the Weather Underground were doing things like, among their gems was something called the Days of Rage. And this particular masterpiece involved a bunch of the Weather Underground people, these self-styled, quote, guerrilla fighters, unquote, running through downtown Chicago and trashing a bunch of small shops business outlets. And this by way of showing their resentment for the establishment. It calls to mind a phrase that we looked at where a French reactionary observed Riley that it's, quote, always best to let a few shops burn, unquote, in order to find it, and basically what he was talking about, in order to really generate a king hell rightward political reaction. If you can imagine, again, the kind of bitterness that was engendered in many people by this kind of thing. If you're a small, you know, say you're a butcher or a tailor or whatever, you're running a small business, and in come a bunch of jerk kids, many of whom were college students from privileged backgrounds, who had turned into revolutionaries, unquote, and their concept of revolution is coming up and busting up your place. And this type of activity has left a very, very disturbing legacy. Not that all or even most of the people who were involved in alternative political activities were of that persuasion, but there were a lot of infiltrators and a lot of well-meaning but not particularly shrewd people who went along with those kinds of activities. And I think it's worth remembering the intense psychological scarring of the German middle class in Weimar Germany as a result of the German Revolution, and reflect on to what extent the California violences, as Mae Brussel has referred to them, may have been intended to produce something similar in this country. More about the Weather Underground and their, quote, revolutionary politics, unquote. Doran's remarks, which she later came to regret, were made at the drug-crazed Wargasm Conference, otherwise known as the National War Council. Held in Flint, Michigan over the Christmas holidays in 1969, this meeting was the weathermen's last public fling before dropping out of sight, a farewell to the shattered remains of SDS and the old movement, and a final appeal for comrades to join their underground crusade. There was general agreement that armed struggle was necessary to smash the, quote, imperialist mother jumper, unquote, not the words used in the book, and much of the discussion focused on possible terrorist actions. Again, repeating this phrase. There was general agreement that armed struggle was necessary to smash, quote, the imperialist mother jumper, unquote, and much of the discussion focused on possible terrorist actions. Someone proposed attacking the Strategic Air Command base outside of Dayton, Ohio, to knock out an H-bomb. It's time to get down, the Weather Bureau declared. Any kind of action that frigs up the pig's war, not the phrase used in the book, and helps the people win is a good kind of action, unquote. At the close of the four-day conference, the Weather people dropped acid and danced all night long while Sly Stone sang, "Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself" over and over again on the phonograph. A terpsichorean frenzy filled the room as everyone burst into Indian war whoops and spirited chants. Women power, struggling power, Red Army power, Saran Saran power, Charlie Manson power. Some had dressed in hippie garb with headbands, beads, and capes, while others wore leather jackets and chains for the wargasm climax. It was like a collective puberty rite, one participant recalled. There was heavy laughing, heavy expletive deleting, until the wee hours of the morning when they all dispersed. Before long, approximately 100 of the weather cadre were living clandestinely with the avowed objective of making war on the state. That may have been their avowed objective. One wonders how many of them realized that they were going to become the fodder for Ronald Reagan's eventually successful election aspirations or presidential aspirations. Because, again, Ed Butler is working for one of the main people behind Reagan. And people, there's a lot of rumination in the press these days about the Reagan Revolution. What does it mean? Is it over? Did it ever really exist? You know, a lot of people are starting to take a look at the deficits and a lot of other things and say, what happened? You know, what happened to the EPA? You know, what happened to OSHA? What happened to a lot of things? What happened to the idea that the Justice Department was the Justice Department? A lot of people are sort of realizing that nobody's been minding the store. But when you think about, you know, the popularity of Ronald Reagan, who's a pretty shallow act when you get right down to it, this kind of thing should be borne in mind because, in my opinion, and this I'll let Nip respond to this, maybe he agrees, maybe not, an awful lot of the political currency that Ronald Reagan has been able to bank in the 1980s was minted in the 1960s. That people were so upset by this kind of thing, you know, the burning of the American flag and things of this kind, which got a lot of media play, even if there weren't that many people doing it. And there were a fair number of people engaging in that kinds of activities. But the year of the fork, this kind of stuff, that really didn't play at all. It doesn't play today, but it sure as heck didn't play in the 1960s. And just the strong gut-level reaction of a lot of people in a rightward direction is a lot of what Reagan is playing on. They've seen everything they considered just twisted so far out of shape, everything they considered, quote, you know, right and American and so forth, that anybody coming along simply manifesting the most superficial trappings of Americanism as they traditionally thought of it is going to go is going to be able to travel a certain amount of road on the fuel provided by the year of the fork.
Yeah, I would have to generally agree. Not generally, I mean, I would have to very specifically agree. One of the things that I think is really important to realize in a larger sense is that you're talking about a very difficult time anyway that in the United States, and it's very difficult to get any person to change their political views, especially when it's for the first time that they're being challenged over views that they've had. We're talking here about changing the views of millions of Americans, which was what was going on, actually, in a fairly organic way because of, for the first time, being involved in a war that not only was not a good one and one that we could not win, but one that there were some legitimate, I mean, real strong moral questions about to everybody. I mean, even all but the most super patriot kind of people had moral questions about Vietnam. So it's hard enough to get people to change. But again, as we keep saying, the worst possible way to get somebody to change their beliefs is to run up to them, say, you're a swine. Everything that you think you stand for is excrement and, you know, everything that you've ever believed in is wrong, and you have 25 seconds to start thinking like me. It doesn't work, folks, and I think any of us who's ever been in a situation of having to work with other people realizes that. But unfortunately, quite a few of the people who took that attitude in the new left or whatever, you know, did it legitimately thinking, my God, don't they understand? It's all so clear, you know, the fervor of the convert. But a lot of other people, again, were either just plain stupid and arrogant, or they were being manipulated, and, you know, we've all been guilty of it. It's really easy when you're 19 years old, and, you know, you think you've discovered the secret of life. God knows, all of us remember being a lot smarter when we were 19 than we are now that we're in our 30s or 40s or whatever. You know, we're not anywhere near as sure about things, so... It was a real tragic thing in that it a lot of Americans were probably getting very close to being able to make at least some accommodation, as we've seen with some of the aspects of the civil rights movement and stuff that have stuck. But a lot of them were really scared off, probably tragically so, never to return by just this sort of thing. The Year of the Fork, the Manson family, the Symbionese Liberation Army, and a variety of other planned and unplanned provocations.
Not only that, but a lot of the younger people who were involved to that kind of, I'll speak for myself here, and I think I speak for a lot of others, were alienated by a lot of the stuff. I was involved with the anti-war movement and wound up cutting it loose because there was a lot of this kind of activity. People were talking about the revolution, quote-unquote, and I was saying, yeah. Well, no, wait a minute. I thought we were here to end the war, And they'd say, well, first we've got to, all I did that, every other word was imperialism. And,
right.
I cut it loose relatively early. And I myself have never really had much to do with the left as such since. Although, granted, given what I'm doing, I'm going to be considered, a wild-eyed red because I say things that are nasty about the government, which is the operational definition of the same these days.
Well, yeah, I have always considered myself to be left of center and, progressive or whatever you want to call it, certainly liberal and all that. But I remember very distinctly being in high school and having friends who were members of various local leftist cadres like Vince Ramos and things like that. And they would keep talking to me about the workers and, what the workers were going to do when the revolution came.
What the workers are going to do when the year of the fork gets proclaimed is bash the heads in of people like that.
I would say, here you are, and really, so, I mean, it was a terrible cliche, but here a lot of these kids were Palo Alto, upper middle class kids whose parents were doctors and lawyers, and they're like 17 years old, and they're telling me what the workers are going to do when they go in and liberate the workers from their color TVs and their hard-won houses in the suburbs and their car and their nice little bank accounts so that they're not going to starve when they retire. Mm-hmm. And they're telling me about relieving the workers of these responsibilities so the workers can rise up. And I said, you poor fools, just try that on a few workers today on your way home, Politics here, folks, and politics is the art of the possible, as somebody once said, and something that sometimes we fail to keep in mind. Anyway, one thing we also have to keep in mind is that you've been listening to us for about an hour without a break, and we're going to do just that. We're going to take a few minutes off and play a couple of songs, give you a chance to get up and run around. And, well, we've had the Day of the Fork and every man dress in every closet and a chicken in every garage or whatever. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with more of this particular One Step Beyond, namely our continuing archive program on Satanism, mind control, and cults, etc. And we shall return with that in just a few moments right here on KFJZ. Get back to the show. We are talking, we have been talking in a fairly specific way, actually, right now, about some various connections, as detailed last week in even more depth, between the John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy assassinations, the Manson family killings, and some other things of that ilk. And we've been talking about Ed Butler specifically and his delineation of the Manson family before the Manson family had been arrested as a gang of radicals out to prey on the innocent civilian populace. And then for a while, Dave and I wandered afield into some of our own feelings about how this kind of stuff plays in middle America.
This after an examination of how the Weather Underground clasped the Manson family to their bosom and espoused that kind of activity.
Absolutely. Now we're going to be talking, going back specifically to the subject of Satanism, or that is Satanism in quotes.
Yeah, now, in a sense, we're remaining in the same context, but we're going to examine a different example of what we feel is the same sort of thing. We're examining now these satanic cults as not only fronts for mind control and specifically Nazi political activism, but we're going to take a look at these satanic cults as vehicles for a particular form of terrorism. And here again, Mae Russell's landmark work on the Symbionese Liberation Army, on the California violences, stands out here. And we have referenced that back to the Fritz Haarmann case, a very, very important apparent provocation in Weimar Germany, which did much to taint liberal politics in Weimar Germany with the onus of corruption, incompetence, Satanism, sexual perversion, etc., etc. We've dealt with the Fritz Haarmann case both in our program on the Pink Triangle and in the second of our programs about Satanism. But we're in this program specifically looking at these satanic cults as vehicles for terrorism, and specifically serial killings. In the case that we're about to look at. Again, this is something which might seem to people to be a little bit far afield from a program which deals with the intelligence services and fascism, but the handling of crime by the news media, the portrayal of crime by the news media, is a very, very political thing. Just examine the next time Archie Fain turns up someplace, the next time he is thought to be turning into a peeping Tom, or the next time Lawrence Singleton is released into a town, or the next time one of these cases comes up, listen to all of the airtime devoted on talk shows to this kind of a thing. The depredations of serial killers and the release of some of these horrible killers into the community after what is usually perceived as too soft punishment has played a very important role in portraying the liberal politicians in this country as a bunch of pointy-headed fools who just don't know the value of good discipline, and they allow they won't pass tough laws, they won't build enough jails, they won't give these criminals the kind of treatment they deserve, so they're always being turned out onto the streets of our fair community where they continue to commit these kinds of outrages. This is a very, very strong political a very, very strong card in the political hand of the far right in this country, and one which has been used to good advantage. We're going to touch on the Night Stalker case here for a second. Just recall the brouhaha when Richard Ramirez was allegedly killing all of these people in the time up to his arrest. It was the biggest story around. And the California violences, you know, the Zodiac Killer, the Zebra Killer, the Manson family, all these kinds of things, have again had a very, very profound political effect. They produced the sensation that society is full of these raving lunatics who could pop out of the woods at any minute. It creates a desire for strong police powers, a lot of prisons, and generally creates a climate very favorable to right-wing reaction. And it is an intensely political phenomenon, although one which has tended to remain outside of the gaze of most political analysts.
All right, we're going to read some, well, not just this one article, but during the course of the broadcast this evening, several sections from an article originally published in the Penthouse magazine of January 1986. The article is entitled, "The Devil Made Me Do It," subheaded, "Satanism is a Nightmare Come True, a Nationwide Epidemic of Evil." And the article is by Dr. Joel Norris and Jerry Allen Potter. Again, the article originally published in Penthouse magazine for January 1986.
And research credit for this goes to a listener, too.
Skipping down way into the middle of the article here. Allegations of possible satanic activities surround two California serial murder cases that have made national headlines in the past few months. Specifically, the Leonard Lake Charles Ng case in Calaveras County and the Richard Ramirez Night Stalker case of Los Angeles and San Francisco. Not since the Charles Manson family cult murders of the late 60s has a case produced such widespread public concern or publicity as has the investigation, capture, and incarceration of Richard Ramirez, the 25-year-old Mexican-American tagged by the media as the Night Stalker. Unlike the Hillside Strangler case or the Skid Row Stabber case, the Night Stalker series of brutal murders, robberies, and assaults brought terror to middle America. Night Stalker victims were middle and upper middle class, and were not just of one sex or age. Ramirez additionally exhibited several signs of Satan worship that have been confirmed since his arrest. Ramirez has a tattoo of a pentagram, a symbol associated with witchcraft, on his left hand. Ramirez's acquaintances have stated that for the past few years he wore only black and carried only black valises. Cassettes of heavy metal music containing satanic references were found in his possession at the time of his arrest. Painted pentagrams were left on the walls of some victims' homes. A shoe print was found at one of the murder scenes that matched footprints that were found at a site in East Los Angeles, known to be a meeting place for cult societies. Clarilynn Balazs, or Balazs, B-A-L-A-Z-S, said that her former husband, Leonard Lake, quote, was a pagan and a devout survivalist, a person who looked for his philosophical underpinnings in a vigilant and perhaps compulsive manner, unquote. Balazs said that when they first met, Lake associated with, quote, white witches, and that she had once accompanied him to a witch's ball in Berkeley, California. Balazs stopped giving information to the media and police after she was told by her attorneys that she could be incriminating herself, and has since stopped talking. A couple of points quickly. One, because we got a letter from a listener talking about the difference between the groups that I think probably are being alluded to when it's being called white witches, namely that practitioners or believers in the religion of Wicca, which is a nature religion and has little or no reference to Satanism, except for the fact that it in the Middle Ages it got lumped in with satanic practice, and witches became known as minions of Satan. But Wicca as a religion, and what are usually called white witches, are not in fact hooked into Satanism.
Well,
although,
not necessarily.
I was going to say, although Leonard Lake's group of quote white witches we know nothing about and could have been anything whatsoever.
This case harkens back to my my warning, I guess you could say, at the beginning of the broadcast, that in any involvement in any of these activities can lead you into this kind of thing, specifically because occult groups of all types are used for infiltration and for recruiting purposes. And people, I'm not going to pass judgment on it myself, but people should at least be aware, for the sake of their own physical survival, of the potential for getting involved with something like this. Because once you get involved with mind control, you not only generally can't get out of it, but you don't know you're under it. It's one of the insidious parts about it. I've personally known people that I thought were pretty rational and pretty well balanced, who got involved in some cases just with some of these self-help groups, some of these gurus, and by God, they came out of it right-wing as hell. There's, you know, a bunch of screaming fascists within a relatively short period of time, and I have been unable to try to convince them of that. They will not accept the fact that they're under mind control.
One of the end things is interesting, too, and it's not mentioned because of when this article was written, but Richard Ramirez, much in the manner of Charlie Manson, in his much shorter time in the spotlight, decided to compound the Satanism allegations, and I believe even at one point as he was being led out of court, he yelled something to the effect of, I did it for Satan, or I serve Satan, or praise Satan, I believe was the word that the phrase that he used. So whether this is something that is merely a pathetic character searching for some kind of notoriety, or a genuine Looney Tunes who thinks that he does serve Satan, or somebody who's been manipulated or is even consciously himself a manipulator, we don't know. But he has gone even further than this in terms of making it a front page Satan worship story.
One of the California violences, which was one of the most gruesome, was the case of Charles Ng and Leonard Lake, which exploded on the scene just about 3 years ago, in June of 1985. As indicated in this particular article, Leonard Lake himself had been traveling in occult circles and eventually, apparently, quote, black magic or satanic circles. It's interesting here because there are a lot of interesting similarities between the Leonard Lake situation and some of the characteristics of the process umbrella cult that we've viewed in the past. One of the interesting things is that apparently Leonard Lake got involved with the occult group, which spurred him to much of his activities while in the military. So did David Berkowitz when he joined the process umbrella cult. We've seen a lot of links between some of these satanic cults and the military. Of course, the Temple of Set, discussions in connection with the Temple of Set that other high-ranking military intelligence people, other than Michael Aquino, may have been involved in this particular group. John Carr, one of the real sons of Sam in The Ultimate Evil, was in fact found shot to death on Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. There are a lot of links to the military, and those links are specifically why we're looking at this at the moment.
Later in tonight's broadcast, we're going to talk about a man by the name of Gary Heidnik, whose links to the military are more than interesting, and we will cover that later.
Research credit on this also goes to a listener. This from the San Jose Mercury News from June 10th of 1985. A story by Elias Castillo of the San Jose Mercury. It's Dateline Willsieville, headlined, Sacrifices Hinted in Mass Burial. A neighbor of the man suspected of killing at least three people and burying their remains at his remote mountain cabin said Sunday that he once invited her to attend a meeting of a San Francisco cult that practiced life sacrifices, unquote. He scared the hell out of me, Geneva Southern said, as she recalled the invitation from Leonard Lake 2 years ago while having lunch at his home. Lake, 39, died Thursday after swallowing a poison pill while in the custody of South San Francisco police. He had been arrested 4 days earlier on federal weapons charges and for driving a stolen car after a botched shoplifting attempt. A companion, identified by police as Charles Chat Ng, NG, 25, escaped and is now being sought by police. Investigators have said that besides the three people whose remains were found at the remote site, owned by the family of Lake's ex-wife, note that the Lake's ex-wife, Carolyn Baylaz, owned this property. She's never been indicted, and we're going to talk about her attorney in just a second. Investigators have said that besides the three people whose remains were found at the remote site, owned by the family of Lake's ex-wife, and as many as seven others may have been killed and buried there. And San Francisco Police Chief Con Murphy said Sunday that, quote, a number of people who were in contact with the suspects are missing. On the outside, we're looking at about 25 people. The missing include four San Francisco residents, four members of a household near Lakes, a Morgan Hill man, a San Diego man, and three women who appear in pornographic photographs or videotapes found at the ranch or in a car Lake was driving. None of the remains found at the site has been identified, officials said Sunday. Skipping down in the article, Southern, the woman who said Lake tried to entice her to travel to San Francisco, said she had helped Lake waterproof the cinder block structure where police discovered a secret, closet-like room equipped with a two-way mirror. That room, quote, could have been used to hold someone in captivity, unquote, Murphy said Saturday. I didn't know what it was for, Southern said. I never went inside, and he told me it was just a tool shed. The structure is located about 15 feet from the home used by Lake, which is about 5 minutes from Wilseyville, a tiny community about 20 miles northeast of San Andreas. The woman said she talked with Lake about the San Francisco cult when she had lunch with him after 3 days of helping him build the shed. I was eating some soup he had made, and all of a sudden he started saying, I'd like you to come up to San Francisco and come to our group, Southern said. He said the group was very small and very confidential, and they believed in life sacrifices, and if somebody deserved to die, they should be dead, she said. Southern said she told them she disagreed with such a philosophy, but Lake continued to try to entice her. He said, we all sit down and hum and sing this song. He sang the song for me, but I can't remember it, Southern said. She recalled that Lake had told her he had heard of the group while in the military service overseas and had joined it, repeating that statement. She recalled that Lake had told her he had heard of the group while in the military service overseas and had joined it. However, she could not remember the name of the group, although Lake had told her. The woman quickly left Lake's house and said she did not see him again until 2 weeks ago near her home when Lake, quote, asked me if I'd like to come up to his house so we could talk. He said he liked talking to someone intelligent. I started getting nervous and told him no. The woman said Lake also attended 3 meetings of a community Bible class and had brought a cake which he had baked himself to the second meeting. At the first meeting, the woman said, Lake argued with members about religion. He would make statements like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, she said. Among the missing is Charles Gunner, G-U-N-N-A-R, a Morgan Hill man described as a friend of Lake's. According to Gunner's ex-wife, he disappeared 2 years ago with his 2 daughters. Victoria Gunner said Sunday that she had learned that the girls are safe, but she refused to say more. Police Chief Murphy said Saturday that investigators have discovered a diary at the site but have not examined it. However, Murphy has said that, quote, some very bizarre activity has occurred on the property, unquote. Investigators also discovered a videotape showing a handcuffed woman pleading for her baby, authorities say. Murphy said Saturday that the tape showed a partly clad woman being ordered to undress. The woman, who was ordered to perform sexual acts and threatened with death, is begging her tormentors to return her baby. There are a number of things to muse on in this particular about this particular article. Again, one of the characteristics of the process umbrella cult is that many of its members appear to have been recruited in the military, and in fact, it appears to be a front for elements of the national security establishment. Two of the uses that we have cited for satanic cults by the espionage services in the past are for use as assassins, specifically. Recall the statement here by Lakes that anybody who should be dead is killed. And also, we speculated about using some of the sexual rites for the purposes of political blackmail. Recall that videotaping has been a consistent hallmark of many of the aspects of cults. We're going to look at that in a second. And videotaping in a sexual context was one of the things being performed here, apparently, by Messrs. Lake and Ng. It's worth noting also that these guys were doctrinaire racists. Ng was constantly referring to blacks as rugheads, quote-unquote, and referring to offing rugheads. Ng also had an interesting phrase which said it, although it's not in this article here, which said, quote, daddy dies, mommy cries, and baby fries, which is indications of just what sort of a charming fellow he really was. But again, here, we're looking at the possibility that these lone nuts here were not really lone nuts, but may have, in fact, been members of one of these intelligence fronts that we have been examining in this long and admittedly complicated series. And again, we're going to take a look at the possibility that Leonard Lake was not recruited, but rather programmed in the military.
We're going to talk a little bit about that by reading from an article from the San Francisco Examiner for Sunday, June 9th of 1985. This article also, research credit to a listener for this. The article is headlined, History of Medical Problems Plagued Lake. And the article is written by Edvin Bitix of the Examiner staff. Leonard Lake was in the Marine Corps for more than 7 years, twice seeing duty in Vietnam. His military career was undistinguished, and he was given an early honorable discharge after recurring medical problems. Lake joined the Marines January 27, 1964, in San Francisco, went to boot camp at San Diego, and to aviation training at the Naval Air Station in Memphis. After that, he was assigned to El Toro Marine Base in Orange County and then was shipped to Okinawa, Japan. His first tour of duty in Vietnam was from December 1966 to July 1967, well short of the regular Marine tour of 13 months. Captain Ray Farrar of the Marines Public Affairs Headquarters in Washington, D.C. said Lake's duty probably was cut short by medical problems. Farrar said Lake spent his first tour at Da Nang as an aviation technician, coordinating air operations from a van behind the lines. He apparently saw no combat and did not receive a combat action ribbon, the Marines' equivalent of the Army's combat infantryman's badge. Quote, he did not rate that, Farrar said. He was not involved in any specific combat action. After Vietnam, Lake spent time in a naval hospital on the West Coast for, quote, a physical problem, unquote. He was, Farrar said, he returned to El Toro for a year and a half before his second duty in Vietnam, which lasted just 1 month, from October 6th to November 6th, 1970. Farrar said medical problems also were the reason why Lake left his second tour early. He said he could not be specific about the nature of the problem because medical records were not available, but indications are that it involved an infection. After being sent to Camp Pendleton, Lake finished his time in the Marines as an outpatient at the camp hospital, Farrar said. Quote, apparently his medical problem was such that he had to be discharged, Farrar said, and on April 9, 1971, Lake left the Marines before his enlistment was up. Military sources said Lake had a history of mental problems in the Marines, but Farrar said he had no disciplinary action taken against him. Lake's military records list the Vietnam Campaign Medal, the Vietnam Service Medal, and two Good Conduct Medals. Quote, apparently, he stayed out of trouble, Farrar said. Well, obviously, if Leonard Lake stayed out of trouble in the Army, which is not entirely sure, he certainly didn't stay out of trouble after he got out of the Army. And, of course, again, the parallel is rather interesting that that during the late 1960s and early 1970s, there was a rash during the Nixon federal administration and the Reagan gubernatorial administration, there was a rash of bizarre occult and political crimes in California, often thought to be the leading indicator, not only the breadbasket of presidents, I guess you could say, but also the kind of the leading edge of the U.S. public opinion. Then during the Carter and paralleling that the Jerry Brown years in California to a large extent, that pretty much dried up and went away. And then as soon as Reagan comes back in, and then eventually we get a Republican administration in California too, the political crimes and the occult crimes begin to heat up again all over, and now we've had this rash of the Night Stalker cases and mass murders and stranglings more than you can shake a stick at, and of course the Leonard Lake Charles Ng case, which along with the Ramirez case, as I mentioned, was particularly horrifying. Entire families disappeared into the Wilsonville wilderness and into the hands of Lake and Ng.
It's worth wondering too whether perhaps the occult group that Lake was going to in San Francisco, whether that might have had any relation to either elements of the Process Umbrella Cult and or the Temple of Set. And recall that Process Umbrella Cult has connections with the Temple of Set through the Anton LaVey connection.
And remember that Lake told the woman interviewed in the article we read just a moment ago that he had made his connections with this particular group that did living sacrifices, etc., while he was in the military overseas.
Now, we're going to review a little bit about Anton LaVey here and then talk about some other activities here. This by way of tying the Manson family, the Process, Umbrella Cults, the Temple of Set, and perhaps even Leonard Lake up together. I'm going to run through this rather quickly. I'm going to add a little section here to what we were originally going to read. Talking about LaVey, and recall that in the first installment of The Ultimate Evil, we took a look at Anton LaVey's numerous Nazi affiliations. When this again from the Penthouse article from January of 1986 and called The Devil Made Me Do It by Dr. Joel Norris and Jerry Allen Potter. When LaVey married in San Francisco, he entered the City College of San Francisco to study criminology and became a photographer for the police department. In a June 1975 article in Argosy, he recalled, I saw the grimmest side of human nature. People shot by nuts, knifed by friends, kids splattered in the gutter by hit-and-run drivers. It was disgusting and depressing. So he left the police department, took up organ playing again, and soon got involved with black magic and began collecting occult knowledge and combining it into a satanic Bible based on the works of Aleister Crowley, Eliphas Levi, John J. Lovecraft, and Carl Jung. LaVey's Satanism offered the ways for the novitiate to gain personal power. During this time, he organized fundraisers for his endeavors by sponsoring open meetings about Satanism. They were black masses conducted with a carnival flair, showbiz style, incorporating his knowledge of music, colorful Art Deco trappings, and the public's seemingly insatiable hunger for the bizarre. LaVey soon attained celebrity status in the Church of Satan, organized around his own flamboyant personality and his satanic Bible, soon boasted 7,000 members. He was a paid consultant on Roman Polanski's Rosemary's Baby and appeared in several other occult films, playing the part of the devil himself. On behalf of his church, unquote, he courted famous movie stars. Second in command to LaVey was Kenneth Anger, author of Hollywood Babylon. During the height of his glory, LaVey owned a line and walked it around the streets of San Francisco, drove an oversized, custom-built black hearse, and directed the Manson family's Susan Atkins in a review called Topless Witches Sabbath. Atkins' part was to play a corpse. When the rest of the cast left the stage, she liked to stay in the casket because she enjoyed it. Events such as this gave rise to the observation that LaVey's Satanism was simply atheism with psychodrama. While Anton LaVey's Satanism shamelessly exhibited the trappings of a carnival sideshow, another famous Satanist group allegedly employed a more spine-chilling approach. Process, a cold, matter-of-fact title for a seriously satanic organization, was begun in 1962 in London's Mayfair district by Robert and Marianne de Grimston. Robert hailed from an aristocratic family and had a military school background. Marianne was a madam from England. They married and formed the Church of the Final Judgment, which wasn't just a religion but a combination of Satanism and psychotherapy that gained entrance into the human psyche by using generous amounts of personal power and control over others. The Church of the Final Judgment was shattered several times when powerful members disagreed with the leadership. Marianne herself split off from Robert and formed another group. Some fringe members of that first group, however, are among those named in connection with the Manson family and other cult killings. These members' names have not been discovered in investigations and have not been discovered in investigations involving Satanism, but in probes into kiddie porn, child abuse, and drug trafficking. Marianne and Robert had come a long way from Anton LaVey's comparatively mild brand of showbiz Satanism. Recall, interrupting here, that in The Ultimate Evil we took a look at the Process umbrella cult as explicitly Nazi and speculated about its being an intelligence front, something that, in fact, Ed Sanders had speculated about as well. Different from either of these two examples of religious Satanism is Dr. Michael Aquino's Temple of Set. If de Grimston's brand of devil worship was harsh and violent and LaVey's a charlatan's dance, Aquino's particular foray into the netherworld is precise, articulate, and intellectual. Aquino, who surprisingly holds a lieutenant colonel's rank in the United States Army, first met Anton LaVey when the young Aquino visited LaVey's black-painted Victorian home in San Francisco for a lecture, unquote, in 1969. He remembers telling a friend, "We'd better not eat or drink anything they offer us in there, because you can never tell about these people." Aquino, a meticulous intellectual, immediately saw through the show business psychodrama but became interested in the philosophy of Satanism. During Aquino's tour of duty in Vietnam, he corresponded with LaVey, and when he returned stateside, was ordered into the priesthood by LaVey himself. I'm going to skip down here. We've talked about the Temple of Set at great length.